So in this episode, we're going to dive into our hobbies, the non-core activities that might seem like a waste of time at the surface, but we both invested thousands of hours into like random things that will never be our career.
Yeah.
So the question is, why do we do this? Yeah. I don't know which of us is the bigger culprit, but we'll start with who, among other things, is a prolific writer.
Well,
a lot of poetry, but most notably, an entire novel, a good novel that he's never actually, you know, tried to get published.
Well, I did try.
Not very hard. You sent it to one publisher.
I sent it to about eight. And some of them got back to me and were very nice about it, but nobody wanted to actually publish it. apart from one self-publishing place, where I got very excited because I thought they wanted to publish it, but then it turned out I had to pay thousands of pounds to basically publish it myself.
Yeah, of course, these days that's a moot because what the pros do is self-publish on Amazon, which is very easy and cheap.
Yeah, I know that I ought to do it. But there's some kind of weird psychological thing.
The Martian was self-published.
Yeah, I know.
50 Shades of Grey, I think.
I know. I should do it. But there's some kind of weird... Maybe we can get into this. Why haven't I done that? That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
maybe it's part of the same thing of why you wrote the thing in the first place.
Yeah.
So why did you write Water Drops on Burning Rocks in the first place?
Well, one of the weird things is that I couldn't end up calling that because... There's already a film called that, which I genuinely think I was unaware of, which is really weird when you think about it, because it's a very specific title.
It is quite specific, yeah.
And I was so pleased with myself for kind of, apparently to myself, coming up with it, because it sort of has a nice sort of ring and sort of scansion about it, and it's sort of a bit mysterious, but also quite nice visceral imagery. Anyway, this is just a really nice title, and I was very, very pleased with myself. And then I, one day, you know, a couple of months down the line, I Googled it, and it turns out it's already a film, and I must have already seen that somewhere, and it must have lodged in my subconscious. Very, very bizarre experience.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, is it a problem sharing the same name? I mean, you know, even this room, there are a couple of thousand books. You know, at some point you start running out of original names. And there's no shame in reusing one.
It's like that Stephen Wilson song, you know. You wake up to find your dreams are public domain or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a really, really great line. I just thought it was, I couldn't use it once I realised that it was somebody else's.
It was ruined.
Yeah. I ended up calling it Not Dead Gods.
Okay.
Which is clunky and horrible.
It's got a vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did I write it? Well, the same reason that everybody writes. Well, it's the same
Not
reason.
Everybody writes a whole novel. Everyone probably thinks about writing a novel.
Yeah.
Not many people actually execute.
Well, you know, at the time I'd decided to leave what I was doing in London. I was working in financial PR in a job that I actually really liked. But I was sort of, my health wasn't that good, and I decided to leave that. And partly, I didn't just leave it because my health wasn't tip top at the time. I also did want to do something else. I wanted to have a different style of life. I wanted to create. I wanted to be a writer. And, you know, I'd wanted to be a writer even when I was at university.
Mm.
Because it, in my incredible arrogance, I felt like I had something to say.
It's okay.
Which is... No, but it is actually unbelievably arrogant when you think about it. Because... Again, once again, as you know, as Stephen Wilson wrote in another one of his songs, is there anything that I can write that I haven't read? And I think the implication is very, very much no. And the notion that any of us as individuals have something new to say, I mean, it is only the kind of once-in-a-century geniuses that actually say, as Dostoevsky would put it, a new word. You know, the man from underground who says a new word. Yeah, for him... That man was sort of Christ, and then it might have been, you know, Newton or something, and then it might have been, you know, it's really a sort of a very, very rare event.
But one per century is an exaggeration.
But my point is that the idea that I would have something to say is almost certainly a delusion. But it's one that I'm fond of.
But I mean, why would you not? You know, already by that point you'd had a slightly unique set of experiences.
Yeah, I mean, why would I not?
And time to process them.
Why would I not? Because, you know, I'm a product of the English middle classes with a very, very standard upbringing and a very standard issue set of experiences and sort of inbuilt values. You're right. There's no logical or empirical impossibility in me having something new or worthwhile to say. But my point is that, you know, it's incredibly unlikely. And so to have that belief and to believe it strongly enough to actually act upon it is surely hubris.
And yet you wrote the whole book.
I did, yeah. Well, that's my point.
Yeah, okay.
Incredibly hubristic. I enjoyed writing it. You know, writing is a form of discipline and meditation.
Mm.
Which again is an incredibly hubristic thing to say because it implies that I am both disciplined and able to meditate. But I did enjoy doing it. I enjoyed the structure of writing 2 hours in the morning, then having an hour's break, having a coffee, doing another 2 hours, and it becoming a kind of a, you know, a routine, which was very meditative. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And also, I guess, what else would you be doing that time?
Yeah,
and unquestionably, compared to just watching Netflix.
Yeah.
No one's going to argue that was a less good use of time.
Yes, well, it gave me a sense of meaning when otherwise, you know, my life was very much undirected because I was just sort of recovering my health and, you know, I had you know, my particular health issue just involved a lot of rest and a lot of sort of gradual increase in activity over many, many months.
Mm.
So, you know, there wasn't really much else to do. There wasn't much else that I had to do other than that, which obviously leaves your entire sort of intellectual mind free because it's all everything that you're doing is basically physical. What I found was that we go through school and we go through university with it very much a fundamental implicit expectation that we are going to spend our lives productively. And we're going to get a job and we're going to work and we're going to earn money and we're going to buy a house and start a family and all, you know, all of that kind of thing. And suddenly in my sort of mid-20s to find that I couldn't do those things, at least for a little bit, is a very disconcerting experience. And so I think I had to be productive somehow. I had to feel that I was doing something that could at least theoretically be classed as productive or leading to some sort of, you know, output or possible career. To sort of justify that time.
But I don't fully buy that, though, because you still write a bit now.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
When you are fully employed, more than.
Well, it's the thing that is difficult to do without, because it's... I don't know, this is going to sound incredibly... pretentious.
Go for it.
But I feel like it's the only thing that really justifies my existence. Because I feel like it's the only thing. I mean, anybody, a lot of people can teach.
Mm.
But only I can write what I particularly would write.
Yeah, I mean, some would argue that only you can teach in the way that you teach as well.
Well, I agree with that, actually. I agree with that. I don't think that this belief that I have about writing is actually rational or fully defensible in the end, but it's something I feel rather than something that I would intellectually defend to the death.
Yeah, so, I mean, you started off saying it was about the process, it was about filling the time, about giving yourself direction. But now,
I think that's a proximate cause.
Okay, so that might have been the activation energy, but actually... It's creating something worthwhile.
Why do that writing instead of, I don't know, you know, doing something else that I could have done feasibly in that time, like, you know, learning to, you know, be a carpenter or something like that, yeah. which I think is very worthwhile. That's the question, isn't it? Why write instead of some other meditative, productive activity?
What do you mean by meditative?
Well, I think that when you are going through a life event that calls into question the future of your life, you know, that imply that basically might result in the future not being what you thought it was going to be, I think that you, well, I certainly naturally gravitate towards a meditative activity in that time, because you are looking, because otherwise you end up with your foot on the accelerator mentally, but also with the handbrake on, because you can't do anything and yet you feel like you have a massive problem to solve.
Yeah.
And so actually you need to find something that is meditative in that time to sort of tranquilize, not tranquilize, but subdue those tendencies in your own mind and do something that basically sets it on a different, in a different direction, doing something that's better for it.
Yeah, I guess there's an analogy with power stations.
So there is.
No, well, one of the problems we have with renewable electricity,
yeah,
is that it's intermittent. You know, it's either windy or it's not. It's either sunny or it's not. And that means that you need the entire generating capacity that you have in wind and solar in backup gas generation. And the problem is that's quite inefficient because a gas turbine, if it's just running all the time, it's very cheap and easy to run and lasts for ages. If you're turning it on and off all the time, it does a lot of damage turning it on. It's all that pressure on the valves and things like that. But also it means you've got unutilized assets sitting there most of the time whilst it is blowing wind.
Yeah.
And so that's losing money. And where am I going with this? Well, having to turn something off and then turn it on again,
yeah,
is stressful. And for many people, impossible. If you turn it off, it's very difficult to turn back on again.
And I think that is absolutely true with writing, that you cannot fit it into the gaps in your life. Well, if those gaps are not predictable and regular, you can't shoehorn it in here and there. For me, anyway, it has to be a regular, scheduled, disciplined thing.
Okay. I meant more that if you're sort of turning off all your intellectual output for the period of your recovery and then turning it back on again.
That would be
difficult.
Yeah. Yes, that would be very difficult.
Yeah.
And you need something that is intellectually productive, but sustainable. And yes, that isn't going to drive you up the wall with frustration.
Yeah.
You need to create. I think we have a... In all of us, we have an urge to create, and we think of that in the modern economy as to produce, and they are almost synonyms, producing and creating, but they're not quite. And I think that you can think of creation as like the most meaningful form of production, and if you can substitute the productive output that you would be doing in a kind of salary job with something that is creative, that is both, it satisfies the urge to produce, and it also satisfies that more individualistic, hubristic urge to create at the same time. I think that was what was going on. And I think that ultimately, the ultimate and most fundamental reason is going back to that idea that of having the arrogance that I felt like I could write something that was good. I felt like I could write something that was good, that was worthwhile, that you know, the world needed to hear. Which, of course, is absurd.
Well, I mean, there's difference between writing something good and something that the world needs to hear.
That's true.
And there's immense satisfaction in mastering a skill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if no one gets to see it.
Yeah, that yes, I would agree with that. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why I don't feel particularly bitter about, well, at least I don't think I feel particularly bitter about the fact that it was never actually published, is because I actually did enjoy writing it so much. And I'm proud of the fact that I wrote it. You know, I have that pride.
So. If you were too worried about the world never having seen it, you probably would have done more on that side.
Yes, I probably would, yeah. Yeah. Well, you very kindly read it, so that's nice. So somebody read it.
Yeah, no, and I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
Do you want to give our listeners a synopsis?
You know, I actually find it sometimes quite hard to remember even what was in the book now. But it was roughly, it was a story of a character who was roughly my age, with many similarities of background and many similarities of characteristics, who got involved with a London arms dealer through many sort of coincidental, fortuitous events. But I think I tried to make it plausible.
Yeah, it didn't feel like a deus ex machina. It was all coherent.
Yeah, I tried to make it plausible. And who ended up running guns into West Africa. And they're encountering some forms of religiosity that in the West we are not familiar with anymore, and it having a profound effect upon his psychology, and the kind of the clash of those of, you know, modern witchcraft beliefs that might be found in West Africa, particularly around the Bekasi Peninsula, where I set a lot of the action, and the sort of the monotheist mindset which we're the inheritors of in you know, what you could call the West. And so I was very, very interested in trying to tell a story about that mapped out the collision of a monotheist with a polytheist, animist, more traditional human mindset. Because I think that that's the most fundamental thing that's happened to human beings, certainly in our part of the world, in the last, well, since the last ice age. I'd actually say it's more fundamental than the agricultural revolution, is the switch from polytheism to monotheism. And so I wanted to kind of, in a small way, tell a story that was exciting and a bit different and dare I say, exotic, about that also accessed those deeper issues. And so it would almost certainly be cancelled immediately.
Yeah, that's probably the precise content of what went down in Cameroon coming from a white middle-class author.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's interesting, actually, that I wrote it... Yeah, when did I write it? 2015, 2016? Mm. I don't think I would have the courage to... And you know, I actually sent it to publishers and so forth. I'm not entirely sure I'd have the courage to do that now. So even between... Maybe I've just become more cowardly, possibly. But even in that sort of 8 years...
And now you have a career that needs protecting.
Exactly, yeah. Even in that 8 years, maybe, you know, we've become a little bit more censorious or puritanical, or the fear of social judgment has grown.
And it's not like you were being orientalist or anything. I remember doing a huge amount of research, and you're now actually a pretty decent authority in West African shamanism.
That's very kind of you, but I tried not to be orientalist about it, and it actually, my justification was that I'm genuinely interested, I'm genuinely interested from my classical background as well, because I think that the ancients were like, you know, they were more like modern West Africans than in many ways than like us. And of course they are our conceptual and in some cases literal ancestors. So I suppose that my view is that you know, those people living in West Africa are much closer to the human norm than we are, and that we're the strange and exotic ones, rather than the other way around. And, you know, that's my genuine... That's what I was trying to kind of get at in many ways.
I know you've also made the observation that if you want to learn how it felt to live in Rome, looking at African religion is probably your quickest way in.
Yeah, it's trying to imagine a sort of African religion, but in a sort of a developed urban civilization.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Africa now isn't developed and urban in many, and of course it is in many places, but it's that kind of the putting the beliefs together with the geographically determined, you know, civilizational context and merging the two. You have to kind of do a leap of imagination there. But yeah, I do think that in terms of religiosity, yes, go to places like the Bekasi Peninsula, and it's probably much closer than what you'll find in Rome today. I was genuinely interested. It gave me something to research as well, which is always good. It's always good to have something to learn.
There's something in that, isn't there?
That's one of the reasons why I think I suggested that we do these podcasts, because it's an excuse to learn things.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I mean, learning on its own can be empty or it can be shallow, and you think you can know all this stuff, but... Until you actually try and put it to the test.
Yeah.
Either entering the arena and putting it out there, presenting it to the public, or even just trying to explain an idea you've had.
Yeah.
In simple language. you know, adversarial scenario. Like, you don't really know something, or you don't understand something until you can explain it to someone else.
Yes, and you don't really know whether you know it until you've tried to explain it to someone.
Yeah.
Because there are some things, even in the few episodes that we've done, that I've thought beforehand that I really get, but then I've found that I haven't really been able to explain it to you very well.
Yeah.
And I've realised I don't really know it. And I find that in teaching as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's something, a phrase Tyrion Lannister in Game of Thrones used, which is, you know, I read books, I drink wine, and I know things. And it's like, and you see that on various mugs and things, and people try and make that their personality. And actually, that's not quite enough, unless you're doing something with knowledge, or processing knowledge, or trying to use what you've read to create new knowledge or transmit knowledge.
Mm.
I think just being on receive mode all the time is not the full package, is not useful, and ultimately it's not fulfilling.
You know,
you've got to be on transmit.
Philosophers will call it propositional knowledge, and actually that's quite a good name for it, isn't it? Because propositional knowledge implies that you have to be able to put it into a proposition in order to know it. It's no good just sort of having an internal state.
Yeah.
You have to be able to articulate it for it to be knowledge.
Yeah, and yeah, use it in different contexts and weave it into a narrative, which is obviously what you're doing in your novel.
Yeah, but I mean, I actually think that, you know, do I think that I would want to write another novel? Yes, maybe. But do I think that actually novels are the future? I actually am not so sure. I think that the novel is actually a quite a dated medium now, and I think that you can see that because the really influential pieces of human creative art in the modern world are not novels.
Yeah, and you can bring up lots of examples of novels that are immensely popular, but I guess if you look at Harry Potter or again Game of Thrones, really they only became culturally influential when they were adapted into film or television.
Yeah, and you know, Harry Potter's 20 years old.
Yeah.
It's good point. And you know, I don't want to take anything away from Harry Potter. I think I loved it as a child, and I think it's genuinely very influential, and yes, they are absolutely novels. But a lot of what Harry Potter is now is just mass market entertainment, which doesn't make it wrong or bad or, you know, anything like that. But I don't think it's moving the dial culturally. I think that over the last couple of decades, funnily enough, the influence has moved more to things like long form television, podcasts, stuff that engages the reader, engages an audience. In slightly different ways. So I suppose that's another one of the reasons why I wanted to experiment with doing this podcast with you, because I think that actually podcasting is in many ways the influential media of the future, in a way that novels were in the influential media of the future in the 1700s.
You think podcasting is different to radio, which has been obviously an influential medium for most of the last century?
Yes, I do. Because it is it's like long form radio without music. I think it's almost like a more serious and intellectual form of radio.
Mm.
It's a development of radio, of broadcast, in the same way that novels were a development of long form poetry and so forth and so on, and narrative historical prose, you know, in that, you know, you develop these new modified forms out of old forms, and it hits the spot.
Yeah. Although, I mean, there are some radio shows that have been going a long time that are quite like podcasts. You
know? Yeah, well, of course. And there were some...
In Our Time, on Desert Island Discs.
Yeah, of course, I absolutely agree. Yeah. And there were many, you know, written forms of narrative that are very like novels that you know, happened in the centuries prior to what is thought of as the first sort of proper modern novels. I mean, I know that Cervantes is supposedly the first one, but really we're looking at the 1700s.
Yeah, I guess, well, I mean, even like, what's the difference between the Iliad and a novel?
Well, their lives are a route off topic. I don't know, do you want to get my thoughts on that? Well, okay. Well, I mean, so I've given you my... I mean, and actually what I... To round off that discussion, what I most like writing now is incredibly tragically... The oldest form, the most archaic and outdated form of writing, which is poetry,
mm.
which of course, you know, kind of sometimes superficially revives as a sort of fashion, but it is very archaic. It's
yeah. Although I think, I mean, what's the difference between a poem and a novel? I mean, a poem is unquestionably a work of art, I would say. A novel is storytelling.
I think a novel can be a work of art,
mm.
but it isn't necessarily. Whereas poetry, I mean, I suppose poetry isn't necessarily a work of art. I mean, you can have these sort of ditties and limericks, can't you? I mean, would you call them works of art?
Yeah, well, and they're more, yeah, mixed between a puzzle and a joke. I guess funny limericks, yeah.
Yeah. It's always difficult, isn't it?
Big word,
but I know what you mean when, you know, poetry with a capital P is definitely an art form, isn't it?
Yeah. Your purpose is different, I think.
Yeah. You know, my purpose in writing poetry is trying to get to the essence of, I don't know, self-expression. The self-definition. Impact upon other humans, you know, emotional impact, intellectual impact. It's trying to do that in the most direct way possible.
And to me, that's what art is. It's trying to capture a subjective experience in a way that can be communicated to others.
Yes, I would agree with that.
I think you can have all sorts of definitions of art that encompass, you know, urine or whatever, but... Yeah, I think at its heart, that's where it is. And the successful work of art, I think, is how successful it is in...
I would want to add in the idea of beauty into that. In order, even if it's a rather dark emotion that's being conveyed, that art somehow lends it a sense of beauty, for my definition of art. I think that it must have beauty to be art.
Yeah, I guess... The question that you get into what is beauty and things like that, and ultimately our pattern recognizing brains probably see something as beautiful if it is capturing something important.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah. I would describe beauty as a particular kind of pleasure. It's profound pleasure. That's what beauty is to me, or something like that.
Yeah, but then pleasure is an adaptive mechanism.
I agree.
To reward.
Well, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I don't see any problem with it being an adaptive mechanism.
Yeah.
And the most profound pleasure is that which is responding most profoundly to the most profoundly adaptive things.
Mm.
Symmetry, harmony, power.
Yeah, but then things like symmetry and harmony are expressing truths, I guess, experience.
It's chicken and egg, isn't it? They are truth. They express truth. I think that because what is true ultimately for us is what is adaptive. What is true for us is what works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. My contention is also what is beautiful is what works.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's what is the most profoundly... What is the most profoundly true thing is also what is beautiful.
Mm.
And that is the same thing as the most adaptive thing. Is it the kind of the abstraction of what's adaptive to its most fundamental form.
Yeah. And so with architecture, for example, a lot of buildings look terrible, often because they have unnecessary things on it. Mm. It's not purely adaptive. But the one type of building that always looks beautiful is a bridge.
Yes.
Because everything that has to be there, it is purely adaptive.
Yeah. Yes, I would agree with that.
That's yeah, you never see an ugly bridge. Oh, some people try.
I'm trying to think of that one over the M25. But yeah, no, I do.
It's still got a certain grace in its lines.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
You're right. It does. It absolutely does. Your point is well taken. I would agree with that.
I would agree with that.
Even those railway bridges.
Yeah.
The kind of gantries have their own sort of stark.
They do.
Brutalist beauty, I think. But then again, I you know, in the abstract, as long as I don't have to live near it or in it, I quite like brutalism. Well, that's something about brutalism, isn't it? You want to live in it.
Well, unless it's really good. And, you know, some brutalist buildings are extremely adaptive and very nice to live in.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that for me, you know, the reason I the reason I now prefer to write poetry is I think that it sort of is, it's language distilled into its most profound form. It's a bit like in Hyperion, you know, the sci-fi novel.
Yes.
And he says, there's a brilliant line that is something like, novelists of the infantrymen and poets of the snipers. You know, that very, very strange sci-fi novel about resurrecting Keats.
Yeah, and the shrike.
Yeah.
Hanging people on anyway, it's like a tree.
If you've got an interest in sort of weird sci-fi, that's also very, 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 very good.
It's extremely
please
good.
Please do read Hyperion. But no more about that, because no one will know what we're talking about. Unless you've read it, in which case our apologies.
And our respect.
Yes.
No, it's interesting hearing your motivations in doing it, because I also have useless hobbies.
Yeah, go on. Tell me, what are your useless hobbies?
Well, I have a lot of them, and it kind of fall into two brackets. So what one is the ones that I've been doing for a long time, that I started when I was 10 or something like that. Mm. I'm a keen drummer, a keen kayaker, keen rifle shot.
Mm. Are you very good at all of them? Not to inflate your own ego too much.
Very kind.
I've seen you do all three and very good. Actually, no, I haven't seen you kayak in live.
Yeah, it normally happens somewhere very remote.
Yeah.
In the snow, yeah.
But I've seen you drum and I've seen you shoot, and it made me feel extremely small both times. So well done.
Says a man who wrote a 100,000 word book. Also, I got 10,000 words into mine. 10,000 words into mine. And
good time.
So drifted off. Yeah. But yeah, so why do I do them? A lot of it is satisfaction of mastering something.
Mm.
I think that in itself is really rewarding.
Mm.
And occasionally, even now, I'll try and develop a skill I've never done before that I know is going to be hard to develop. Just because that's not really mastering something. So more recently, I do a bit of windsurfing and a bit of jujitsu, and I have no expectation of ever truly mastering these skills.
Mm.
But just learning something from scratch, and something that is difficult to learn. You'll testify that jiu-jitsu is difficult to learn,
yeah.
And painful and hard and exhausting and, yeah. And humiliating.
Very, very tiring.
Humbling.
Yeah, quite humiliating.
and windsurfing too, like the smallest mistake and you're just thrown into the water.
Yeah.
Then you've got to climb back up on the board and haul the sail up, and then you'll go another 100 metres and get thrown into the sea again, and it's cold and the boom hits your head and
sounds great.
So yeah, well, what am I doing?
Well, I mean, why do you think that those? Why are you motivated to develop those skills or attempt mastery of things?
Yeah. So mastery, I think is satisfying in its own right. But learning something new, what's going on there? So firstly, I think it's important. You know, we got a sort of utilitarian argument saying if you stop learning new things, you stop growing as a person, you stagnate, you calcify, and you're just on the long glide path to death.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's something actually more profound than just utilitarianism in the idea of growing as a person. Maybe we could put a pin in that. But yeah, go on, sorry. Yeah, so not just utilitarian, not just the outcome.
Yeah. So, but also, it's, I guess part of it is just having new experiences. Actually, living a bit, or a bit more. I remember someone saying that to be a good writer, yes, you need to read a lot, yes, you need to write a lot, but you also need to live. You need to have these experiences that you're communicating. And if you look at the really good writers, they are people who lived.
Yeah, and have very complicated lives.
Yeah, and so if you had any hubris in writing a novel when you were 25, it's because very few people can write a good novel when they're 25. They just haven't, unless they were literally in the trenches or doing something
very gnarly.
Yeah,
that we tend not to do.
A lot of psychedelics, maybe.
Yeah.
it is quite hard to say something new if you haven't fully explored the old, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yes. So, but I think that, you know, you are actually someone who engages the world on a level that's more profound than just that you want new experiences. I don't think that it's just about the transitory subjective experience.
Yeah, I think you can have a very shallow time chasing experiences. And I think anyone who tells you they love traveling will probably be illustrating that point.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many new experiences you can have without ever internalizing them or learning or developing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking of 1,000 reality shows.
1,000 Hinge profiles.
Yeah. Just love experiencing new cultures. Like,
yeah.
Is that
new foods?
Yeah. Okay.
What did you learn?
Sounds very, very judgmental and arrogant. But there we are.
Yeah, there we are. Yeah. You need to do something a bit more. You're right.
But I think that you are. I do think that that is what you're doing.
Well, so I'd like to think so. Question is how do I back that up?
Yeah.
And so other random hobbies I've.
Well, you see, I don't think the people that say that they just want to have new experiences, there's often very little effort involved for them in having those experiences.
I fully agree there.
And that's in a way why they like it, is because they can just do it and it's like they're doing something profound, but they're not really.
Yeah, this is what triggers me about the experience economy that's sprung up in London where you go for a team building, you know, an escape room or golf simulator or pottery workshop or cocktail making thing. And you're, I think, I'm kind of a snob in that way. I guess my reaction to bungee jumping is kind of, I'm an adrenaline snob.
Yeah.
I don't trust people. and so that's very difficult.
I mean, that's why
if you've gone to bungee jump. Yeah.
Yeah.
But part of it is that, the greatest adrenaline highs I've had are a result of having worked for years to develop a skill to the point where I can put myself in a situation that is hairy and through my own skill get out of it alive.
Yeah. I remember you telling me a story about a time when you were trapped in a cave with the water level rising when you were kayaking. And there's something about logs hitting you. And I remember, the fact that this must have been about 12 years ago, you told me this story, and it's very much lodged in my mind.
The Verdon Gorge in south of France, I remember it well. there have been a couple of incidents kayaking obviously a gnarly pro would look at these experiences and dismiss them, but to me they were quite profound at the time, yeah.
Well, I don't know what you're obviously in your mind, a gnarly pro is someone who's so Olympian that, is not even in sight of us mere mortals.
Exactly. It's the people, if you're going down the rapids of the River Congo with a helicopter 5 foot above you in case something goes wrong.
Wow.
I'm never going to touch that. But, I feel that to have a profound experience, whether that's an adrenaline high or learning, you've got to put the work in first. You can't just be given it on a plate. And I think if you go to a foreign country and just stay in a youth hostel and hang out with other people there and do the standard tourist trail, you're not putting any work in.
It's fun, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not profound.
No.
I've hung out in a youth hostel in Italy. Had a great time. But
it's a lot of fun.
I don't think it was particularly profound.
Yeah.
So do you think that there's any link to the idea of virtue here? I mean, the idea that obviously virtue is an ethical word, and ethics involve action, but they also involve character. They involve, your being. If you are more virtuous, then that's something about you as an entity, not just your experiences. Do you think that by having to work at something that you are, that is related to developing virtue? I'm trying to think of a way of characterizing, of getting to the heart of what you're saying that you gain from suffering for something rather than just having it given to you on a plate. What is it that you gain?
Serenity? Well, you're in control of your own destiny for that 5 minutes down the waterfall or whatever.
But are you really in total control? Because, I'm not so sure that when you go through that experience and you get out of it through your own skill, that's because you're in control of what's happening. It's more that you have the ability to influence what's happening by keeping your head and deploying the skill that you've learned.
Yeah, definitely. You're not in full control if you're in the wilderness. You know, if you're mountaineering or if you're kayaking or something like that, you are absolutely at the mercy of...
But what you are able to do is deal with that.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what I would not be able to do when if I was going down that river, I don't think.
Without putting a couple of years of work in.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you've learned is the ability to deal with not being in control.
Yep.
And would you characterise that as something that's quite fundamental, do you think?
Yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way. So the question is, if you don't put yourself through these things and life throws a curveball at you, where you're not in control, do you deal with it any better of having purposefully put yourself in that situation?
I think definitely. I mean, the way that you deal with stressful things is I only detect the slightest ripples of concern in your demeanour when there is something incredibly stressful. Like, I remember when we were leaving our flat that we'd lived in together and you hadn't even started looking for a new flat. We were buying one and it was something like 3 weeks' time. And I said to you, you know that buying a flat takes quite a long time. I didn't even detect a ripple of real anxiety there. And there's been many, many other things that like that, but they're actually more serious, where I haven't really been able to detect much. You just kind of deal with it.
I mean, that might just be stupidity.
No, but I don't think it is. I don't think it is stupidity. I think that, you know, where I'm actually quite bad at dealing with a lack of control, and I get quite worked up about it. You just don't. You're just the opposite of me. And I think that's because you've done far more of this stuff.
There is a theory that leaving your comfort zone is stressful.
Mm.
And so you need to be actively working to expand your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Because that means that you find situations less stressful so you can better handle them. If you don't exercise that, if you don't actively work to expand your comfort zone, it will shrink. And your comfort zone will get smaller and smaller. Yeah. And I think that happened to a lot of people in COVID, for example, where their comfort zone became their sofa and Netflix. And actually, you know, leaving your sofa and Netflix became quite stressful. And it's a lot of work to get out of that hole.
I totally agree. I think that's absolutely right. I think that this is where I would go back to that idea of growing as a person, which sounds like a kind of cliche throwaway comment. But that is it, isn't it? You're growing your capability. You're growing your comfort zone.
Yeah.
By doing those things. And the way I would characterize that, being a classicist, is I go back to Aristotle's virtue theory. I think that when he's talking about virtues, I don't know whether you're familiar with Aristotle's virtue theory.
Tell me about Aristotle's virtue theory.
It's quite simple in the end. He says that basically a virtue lies between two vices.
Mm.
So the classic example would be you have recklessness and you have cowardice. Mm. And in the middle of that is courage. And he basically said that if you can nurture these virtues that are the sort of the mean, the golden mean between these two vices, then you will achieve what he called eudaimonia, which in Greek sort of means good-spiritedness, or it might mean satisfaction. Some people translate it as happiness. I don't think that's quite right. It's more like, you know, profound satisfaction. And so I think that all of the, you know, his virtues are, they're the appropriate way of dealing with difficult situations, the extremes of life. And it's about knowing what the appropriate courses between two wrong courses. It's mitigating the extremes in either direction and holding that steady middle course no matter what life is throwing at you. And so he says that you can only really do this through, you know, dealing with situations. And that it has to be learned. It's something it's forged. The virtues, they're forged through experience. You have to live them.
It's embodied.
Embodied. You can't just work them out with your sort of, you know, pen at your desk and then your job is done ethically. You have to live it. And then once you've developed them, then you can deal with more and you're more likely to achieve eudaimonia, because life isn't going to throw you off course, no matter what it does.
Mm.
So I would say that's the background to why I would say, well, is what you're doing when you're having to work for something is that you are developing a virtue. And another way of putting that might be that you are expanding your comfort zone so that you can react in a moderate but appropriate way, not react in an extreme way in a greater variety of circumstances.
Yeah, so I guess that's a mirror is almost the Christian virtue of meekness, which is, you know, the word used to describe a war horse, where it's a huge amount of power but under control. You know, uncontrolled power is useless, but not having power at all is useless as well. You need to be in between the two.
Yeah, you need to, yes, exactly. You need to have control of yourself in these situations. And for that, you need to be at least partly in some sort of comfort zone.
Yeah.
It says, I can handle this, so I will control myself.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I guess in ancient Greece, people had this as part of their lives anyway. Like, it was impossible to live in ancient Greece without being tested routinely.
Every day.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you know, Socrates was a soldier, of course, and yeah, you're very much in the real world. Whether it was wars or famines or hard work or anything.
Yeah.
But these days, speaking as an accountant living in London, it doesn't happen naturally.
No, but you've always been a very great traveller, haven't you?
I'm an accountant living in London.
the number of places you've been.
Yeah, but again, I mean, hopefully not in the kind of backpacking kind of way.
No, but I mean, absolutely not. I mean, you were in, now correct me when I get this wrong, because I'm going to get the sequence wrong. You were in Egypt when the revolution kicked off there.
I wasn't in Egypt. I was about to go. And then
you were about to go. Where were you? In Lebanon? No.
It was Syria. I was there for 6 months trying to learn Arabic.
Yeah, when did you have to hide in a monastery in the desert?
That was then. The week I was advised to not be in the country, so I went to Iraq. but the longest stretch was in Yemen for a year, just after the Civil War. And so I guess a bit of the real world threw itself at you. There was a slightly high level of danger, but it never got acute.
You did choose to go to these places. I'm interested in what underlies that. Do a little therapy session here.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, running from the reality of having to become an accountant in London.
Yes, but running to sort of quite explosive.
Well, I mean, the sad truth is, I was trying to learn Arabic.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at learning languages.
Yeah, but why were you trying to learn Arabic? Why weren't you trying to learn French and, you know, having a nice time in Provence?
I just don't think there's anything useful in French that isn't in English, or anything interesting in French that isn't in English. Okay. If you're going to go through all the effort of learning a language, you kind of want one that's going to... You know, there needs to be stuff in that language that's not in your language.
Okay, so why not Chinese or Russian or...
I mean, Russian was second base to Arabic.
Okay.
I think Russian would be extremely rewarding to learn.
Yeah, well, Russia's also quite a dangerous place.
I mean, in its own way.
Yeah, but you'd say that about Syria, wouldn't you? You'd say, oh, yeah, it's dangerous in its own way. It's not really dangerous.
Yeah, you know, bits of it are dangerous.
Yeah.
If you do certain things, it's dangerous. But
why do you think that you are drawn to these places that other people would perceive as dangerous?
It's really not about the danger. They're just interesting places to be. I mean, Yemen was just fascinating because I was just immersing myself in a completely different culture. I mean... Again, it's partly to learn Arabic, and I'm terrible at learning languages.
Mm.
And so I need to be somewhere where no one speaks English, otherwise I'll obviously speak English, because that's how I communicate.
Yeah.
And so the idea was that, yeah, by going to Yemen, I'd be forced to use Arabic all the time. And the problem is, yeah, the place where people don't speak English tend to be dangerous.
Yeah.
There's quite a broad pattern.
Is that really the fundamental reason, though, do you think? Because you and your brother are always going off to these fascinating places. Like, you went and rode the ore train in Mauritania long before the Grand Tour got there.
Yeah, they basically copied our itinerary.
Yeah, you go and do these kind of gnarly things in faraway places. You're windsurfing on a beach where the shower is just an outflow pipe and things like that for 2 weeks. And
I mean, part of it is to have the experience. I mean, if you want to know what it was like to live in the 14th century, live in Yemen for a year.
But why do you want to know what it was? Why do you want to experience that?
I mean...
Because I fully buy the whole thing about you need to experience hardship and everything that we've just talked about, but I still wouldn't want to say that I wanted to live in the 14th century.
I mean, you must be interested in what it was like.
Well, I mean, I sort of am, but there's a lot. There's a big space between sort of being interested in the abstract, like I am, and then actually, you know, buying your ticket, driving through the jungle, and being like, right, here we are.
I mean, I've given you three perfectly good reasons you're not buying them.
I know, but
I mean, you're probably right.
I just don't think it's an intellectual reason.
Yeah. So
underlying it.
If we go a level deeper. Yeah. So as I've hinted, yeah, I got 20% through writing a novel. Well, maybe even 50%.
Yeah.
And you did not. And I guess, why did I not finish it? Well, because I didn't think I had anything worth saying. And I felt that, yeah, I needed to experience a bit more to be able to actually, you know, being equal to the authors I so admire. And I mean, the same goes with photography, because that's something else I picked up.
Tell us about photography.
Well, that was frustration. I was kayaking and someone took some photos. And I was, you know, going down some rapid and it felt amazing and it, you know, it was epic. And I was like, oh, these photos are going to be great. You know, I'm going to put them on Facebook and everyone's going to be like, oh, you're amazing. Because I was 19 then and
Facebook was a thing. You're old enough.
Ditto, you're old enough that looking for affirmation from your peers.
Yeah.
neither I care about anymore. And the photos look terrible. Again, you know, they're off an early noughties, you know, cheap digital camera. So it was a very wide angle, but it just looked like it was just, you know, in a puddle, just going, you know, some waves. It didn't look very dramatic at all. So I was like, well, that's not how it felt. I need to work out how to capture how it felt. And so I did all the reading on photography. You know, I got a DSLR off eBay and worked on working out how to use it. And then would always take it kayaking with me and taking photos of people going off rapids just to see if I could take a photo that looked how it felt to run that rapid. And I think I was reasonably successful, but I took the same approach to writing. It's like, yeah, you want to be trying to capture a subjective experience. But at the same time, you need to be having an experience that's worth capturing. But obviously, I take the less mature approach where I think that what's worth capturing, well, certainly when I was 20, is going off a waterfall in a kayak. When actually there's a lot that's worth capturing in our everyday lives, these moments of beauty or pathos or challenge or difficulty, which really you can't capture with a DSLR, even a really good one. And maybe actually
capture
poetry is the only way of capturing some of those moments that are...
Opening your inbox at 7:32 a.m.
Yeah.
And seeing some dreaded...
It's just not a good photo.
No, it's not a good photo.
But it's potentially an amazing poem. Yeah.
And terrible.
Yeah. So
pathos.
Perhaps, yeah, but maturity is saying that, yeah, these experiences, you don't need to be in an exotic location or doing something dangerous. You just need to actually be aware of what you're doing day to day and really think about it. And as you say, meditate on it. It's like, yeah, you can do all this travel and see all these amazing places. And then you suddenly realize, you know, you live in London and you haven't done half these things. So, you know, if you went to, you know, some village in Romania, you know that you would tick off every single thing in the guidebook that it said to tick off. And you do so ruthlessly and efficiently. And then London, we just sort of chill in our houses. And one of the most interesting things I did over lockdown was there's this book, a guidebook of London's lost rivers. So it's all the old tributaries to the Thames, you know, the Wandle and the Effra, the Fleet, the Westbourne. And it just takes you on a walking route down them. And you suddenly just have this completely different view on London. And it transports London into this kind of magical ancient city where you can feel the history and the lie of the land. You don't have to go to Yemen for that.
Yeah.
You just have to walk, you know, 3 miles that way. And so I think, yeah, back to what we're saying about people having these kind of immature experiences, you know, going traveling.
Yeah.
You can travel a long way without leaving your room.
So why do we have these hobbies then? So what does that say about why we have these hobbies? Why are we driven to do this? What are we trying to achieve? Is it that kind of sense of connection with something more profound in life? I mean, that's not a very articulated or well...
Well, should bring together the reasons we flagged already.
Go on.
So there's a satisfaction in mastering a skill.
Yep.
That's innate. There is expanding the envelope, or, you know, increasing our comfort zone. So we therefore cultivate virtue and are better able to handle challenges as they come up. There is capturing and communicating a subjective experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes skill as well as having had experiences.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing of why you would want to do that, but sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Why? Why are we driven to?
Because what's subjective is so fleeting, and yet it's so valuable to us. Yeah. Are we driven to sort of try and capture it and make it eternal?
Well, you mentioned connection,
mm.
and ultimately, it's hard to know what someone else's subjective experience is. But sometimes you come across a poem or a photo that speaks to you.
Yeah,
and it's like I know that. I know
maybe
that.
We're not just microbes on.
Yeah, suddenly you're just not alone for it.
Yeah.
I
think that might be it.
That's three good reasons.
That's three good reasons.
Do you have any additional reasons?
No, I think that is right. I think that it's so easy when you leave your early to mid 20s and you get into what I think of as the main sequence of working to neglect these things.
Mm.
Because you know your job, your employment can become really all-consuming. Because it's never done. Mm. Work is never finished. It's never mastered, or it's very rarely mastered by individuals.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe Warren Buffett has mastered his. I don't know. Maybe
I'm just lucky.
But most of us don't master it. It's too complicated. It's too big. And so you can end up just pouring all of your efforts into that. And then especially if, you know, you have children as well, like they are a huge undertaking in time and effort and energy and just mentally. It's very easy to start to neglect these, you know, hobbies. And I think that can throw into sharper relief the question of, well, what is valuable about having them? Why should I make the effort to maintain having hobbies and doing these things?
Yeah, are they just childish things?
Are they childish things that need to be left behind once you're gainfully employed?
Yeah, once you're a grown adult with responsibilities.
A parent. Or are they actually quite important? And I think that, you know, I hope that we've made the case that they're actually quite important.
I'd say more important than my job, certainly.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, you need them, you know, we need the money, don't we?
Yeah.
Money is important. It's not everything, but it's a kind of a sine qua non.
Yeah, and in its own way, you know, your job, you're also mastering a skill. You're also expanding your envelope.
I'm not saying I wouldn't go...
Experiencing new things.
I wouldn't poo-poo the notion of professional fulfillment at all. I mean, but I suppose that what I'm saying is that actually having something that's just for you, that's just that you have chosen and that you don't do for money.
Yeah, that word amateur is quite a good one. You know, a lover of a thing. You're not doing it for any reason other than you love it.
Yeah. You know, I've never actually thought about the root of that word.
Well.
And I call myself a classicist.
Well.
You're right. It's a lover of the... Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah.
It was worth this conversation just for that insight.
So. Yeah. And on that bombshell.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Okay. Excellent. I think we've dealt with that very well.
I think we have.
Yeah. We got away without actually reading any of my terrible poetry, so let's end it there.